Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Municipals are starting the year semi-flat, and the latest read on CPI will not do much to alleviate the concern of market participants that performance could be stagnant for the foreseeable future. That being said, there are still some areas of relative value, even though the absolute trade-off from last fall has faded to a large degree. Here to join myself and Karen Altamirano to discuss the current market dynamics, credit quality, election predictions, and much more is Jason Appleson from PGIM, Prudential Global Investment Management. For those who are not familiar with Jason, he has all the cool letters after his name, like CFA and FRM, pretty smart guy. He is currently the managing director and head of PGIM's fixed income municipal bond team. Jason has a really interesting background in the muni industry with such roles as being the lead portfolio manager for PT Asset Management and working at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where he was involved in developing a systematic approach to stress testing muni portfolios for the largest financial institutions. And he also worked at a small financial institution, AllianceBernstein, you might have heard of them, as a credit analyst supporting the firm's $30 billion municipal bond fund complex. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start really high level and just sort of the news du jour, obviously CPI, right? A number that is continuing to sort of come in hotter than anticipated and really consternating for a lot of fixed income professionals. You know, how does this sort of play into PGIM's, you know, very high level outlook for rates?
Yeah, good question. You know, CPI, it's true, it came in slightly above expectations, but it's still working its way in the right direction, which is lower. Our house view is what we call weakflation, which is where we think economic growth is certainly going to trend lower than it has been. The 5% we saw in the third quarter or the 3% we saw in the fourth quarter is likely not going to materialize again. But even though growth is marching lower, so is inflation. And I think overall, lower inflation is a supportive backdrop for the fixed income markets as a whole.
I mean, do you see the wage issue becoming more of a problem as we get sort of further into the year? I mean, you know, look, I mean, obviously we're not managing money over here, but certainly our economics team is of the mindset that we're sort of caught in this like wage growth spiral.
Yeah, we don't see it that way. You know, there's certain trends happening in the labor market right now, which are putting pressure on what used to be a very strong picture. One simple example I'd look to is if you look at the labor demand versus labor supply, traditionally that there had been a pretty wide gap between those two numbers. But even though jobs prints continue to come in strong, you know, we had the labor report on Friday, the revisions that we're seeing are certainly pointing to labor demand moving lower and lower. At the same time, labor supply has been ticking up largely due to migration or immigration, I should say. Sure. And as that number, as those two numbers converge, I think the market picture, you know, for labor at least, won't be as strong as we've seen over the last year or so.
Yeah. I mean, where do you see the 10-year going? You know, where is PGIM sort of forecast for end of the year 10-year treasury rate?
Yeah, so we have a pretty wide band on what we believe the treasury 10-year would be, somewhere between 4 and 4.5%. But I think it's important to really understand the backdrop here, which is one that's supportive for fixed income generically.
Yeah.
Again, you have inflation ticking down. You have the economy slowing. These are the things that the Fed wants to see so that they can start moving the short-term rates lower. And when the Fed comes in and cuts rates, obviously, that's a supportive backdrop for fixed income.
All right. So on the Jason Appleson dot plot chart, how many cuts are you seeing for the remainder of this year?
Our house view is 3, just like the market and just like the Fed.
All right. All right. Just right on consensus. I like it.
Consensus.
So, yeah. So let's sort of take the migration issue and sort of pivot that a little bit into one of the big issues this year, and it's obviously the election, right? And that's going to impact our market in a very big way. Or is PJM taking any sort of approach and forecasting where you think the election might end up, assuming that the presumptive nominees are the two gentlemen that we sort of have left standing at this point?
Yeah, it's hard to have a view here away from the polling that we see, but we certainly are considering the ramifications of any outcome for the election. You know, there's certainly a number of permutations between Congress and who will be in the White House. But, you know, we're talking about immigration, for example. Mm-hmm. So if Trump is elected president, as an example, what will immigration look like at the border? Well, that'll be shut down. So what that does to the broader economy is sort of a second order effect in terms of the labor market. But maybe it has a more direct impact on cities like New York City or Chicago, who have been struggling with their budget due to the immigration costs.
Yeah. I mean, the White House just put out a budget yesterday, forecasting the deficit to expand. I think it was like $19 trillion. You know, absent of any tax hikes, right? And the things that they're proposing seem pretty onerous on face value, but at the end of the day, pretty good for our market because higher taxes obviously result in larger demand. You know, have you guys given any thought as to sort of like where the muni market will be impacted, you know, given a Republican nominee in the office or a Democrat nominee in the office?
Sure. Again, I would say you have to consider who's in the White House, but you also have to consider what Congress looks like. But to your point, if Biden is elected president and, you know, we start to look at some of his policies, including a 28% corporate tax rate or a minimum 25% individual tax rate on wealthy individuals, that's only going to increase the demand for municipal bonds from this point forward. Conversely, if Trump is elected president and he lowers individual and corporate tax rates, that would have the reverse impact on our market. So it's very important to look at what is going to happen given who's in the White House and who's in Congress. But perhaps more importantly, I think what our market is focused on is in 2025 with certain tax provisions rolling off, you know, will that increase the demand for munis or will some of those tax provisions get extended? And ultimately, we'll have a similar demand picture that we have today.
So speaking of those TCJA provisions, where do you see some of those possibly ending up? What are your predictions?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, you know, let's just assume you have a split Congress and you know, the president is either Republican or Democrat. So I think given the progress we've made on certain policies in Congress this year, I think we'd be slow moving going forward. So they will be contentious arguments about, for example, does SALT deductions, do those get extended? You know, do certain other provisions like individual income tax get extended and so forth? And it's really hard to judge today, but in a split Congress, it's hard to imagine things moving forward seamlessly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of our view as well, that you might have some things done by executive order or just sort of, you know, trying to sort of circumvent, you know, the channels a little bit more. And split Congress and the White House is a very, very real possibility with either candidate. So it's going to be an interesting season for sure. But I think either way, taxes are probably not going much lower than where we already are. We sort of, you know, sort of know what we're going to get with a Trump regime at this point. I think, you know, a second dose of President Biden just might take a lot of people by surprise from a taxing standpoint, which, you know, I don't know about you. I certainly pay a lot of taxes, so it's not going to be fun.
I live in New Jersey. You don't have to explain that to me.
Oh, yeah. So let's go back to the SALT thing. I mean, is that actual a thought in PJM's mind or your mind that could actually be expanded? It seems to me people have sort of just like accepted the fact that we have a $10,000 cap at this point and just sort of moved along.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly an argument. And what's interesting here is, you know, a lot of Democrats, especially from urban areas of the United States, you know, it's impacting their districts more disproportionately. So, you know, I think there's incentive there to push the issue, whereas on the Republican side, obviously, you know, that represent smaller districts that aren't taxing as much, don't have as high property taxes, don't have that same push from their constituency to make those changes.
What are your thoughts on advance refundings coming back, and would that change the market at all?
Ooh, could they come back?
Yeah, I mean, advance refundings prior to 2017 were quite a large piece of the supply puzzle, you know, to call it 10-15% on a given year. If those were reinstituted, I think we could certainly see supply increase. You know, just walking through the different iterations before, you know, right after 2017, the taxable market was used to pre-refund a lot of these tax-exempt munis because of the rate markets were in a very different place than they are today. And, you know, now we don't have that same tool because taxable rates have gone much, much higher and the economics have changed dramatically. So I think, you know, having tax-exempt refinancing back in the market would lead to higher supply, which could affect the technicals of the market.
Look, I don't think anyone's denying the fact that the market has changed since 2017. It's changed over the last 2 years, you know, pretty dynamically. You know, what are your thoughts on sort of the further retailization of our market, you know, that shift to, you know, more passive, low cost strategies, you know, a la SMEs versus, you know, traditional mutual funds, obviously, which you guys are focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of interesting to look at the market over the course of time here. Funds and fund complexes have grown pretty dramatically if you look over the last couple of decades. At the same time, dealer balance sheets have fallen, and over that same period too, or at least since 2017, institutional demand for municipal bonds because of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the lowering of the corporate tax rate, demand has fallen in the institutional category. So to your point, it has become a lot more of a retail asset class, but that affects the asset class in a number of ways. There's more... it's driven more by sentiment than it ever has before. You have what we refer to as institutional clients, you know, backing out of the sector who might be more stable in their positioning. But with ETFs too, that's another, you know, change in our market. And I know you didn't ask this, but as that grows in popularity, the liquidity profile as the marginal buyer, marginal seller, there's more volatility created, and especially on the back of smaller dealer balance sheets.
What's your opinion on the mutual fund outflows? We know they've returned a little bit, but do you see them fully coming back?
So it was interesting to watch over 2022 and 2023. We had quite the outflow cycle from open end mutual funds. But I guess what changed in 2023 is, despite outflows in open-end mutual funds, we did see inflows into the ETF space. Mm-hmm. And now, if you look at the beginning of this year till present, you see that dynamic reversing. Open-end mutual funds have really been the source of inflows this year, and ETFs have more or less been flat on the year. So that is changing a little bit. And, you know, to your point before, I think if you look at the municipal market on a spectrum of, you know, the most efficient market to the least efficient market, where maybe you have the most efficient market on one end is, you know, the stock market, and the least efficient market on the other end would be alternatives. Munis have certainly moved towards the inefficient market because of the fragmentation and other inefficiencies associated with the market. And active management plays a very important role the more you move towards that inefficient spectrum. So, you know, that's something that we find very important and why we are active managers in the space.
I mean, that's interesting, because the narrative over the last 2 years was certainly that cheaper beta was the winning tool, right, for investors. But you're saying that you see the shift sort of, or the pendulum swinging the other way in 24 and beyond, that folks are going to be willing to sort of come back and lay out fees for more of a curated active approach?
Yeah, that's our expectation. And, you know, think about it from a very simplistic standpoint. If you invest in the index, right, who are the largest issuers there are going to be the most populous areas of the United States, like California and New York. And we just talked about our high tax rates here. those yields are lower because there's more demand for those bonds. So you have this inefficiency, we could call it index biasing, where you're invested in lower yielding bonds just because of the composition of the index. By taking an active management approach, if you're a national investor, it might make more sense to, you know, jettison more of those specialty states and invest more in national states with no or low income taxes.
So, I mean, talk about a little bit about the active approach. I mean, are you guys able to layer in, you know, higher yielding stuff, taxable options to sort of get more of a mix, or are you more constrained?
So depending on our strategies, I mean, in which we have a number, but, you know, we have everything from a short duration fund to a high yield fund. And, you know, we can do a number of different things, and we're pretty flexible. But what it comes down to is we have a pretty well-staffed research team, and we're doing bottom-up research on a lot of different bonds. And we find we can produce alpha with, you know, lower volatility on a lot of than say the index generically in many years. So, you know, we feel comfortable taking different risks, whether it's credit, industry, individual security, or even structural risk in the market.
I mean, when you say structural risk, could you possibly explain that for the folks who may not know? I mean, Karen and I have a good idea, but, you know, there's probably folks listening who may not know what that means exactly.
Sure. If we go back to our inefficiency scale, one of the things that makes munis so inefficient is bonds that are issued past 10 years conventionally have a 10-year call option embedded in them. Yeah. And that call option is difficult to price. I mean, there are different structures. Certainly as bonds season, that 10-year call could become a 7-year call with a 20-year maturity. And trading those bonds around, especially in a heavily retail-dominated market, there's a lot of valuation that could be exploited with the proper tools. So those are different ways you can actually make money by valuing the optionality of those positions.
So talk to us a little bit about convexity. And at least like how you're sort of viewing it, right? You know, sort of coming off that comment. You know, some of the things that happened in the last 2 years where folks found out that buying discount bonds could be pretty dangerous in a rising rate environment. And let's go on the assumption that, let's say, inflation is here to hang around in its current form, right? Not going any higher, just sort of annoyingly at this level. You know, how does that change your view on how you're talking about structure and, you know, sort of deploying structure calls into the portfolios?
Sure. I mean, in an ideal world, you want the most positive convexity and the least negative convexity, but you want to get paid for any convexity risk that you would take. Again, convexity being the risk that you might extend sometime in the future and your duration becomes a lot longer than you think it is. But to your point, I mean, we've gotten hit quite a bit with higher rates. And one other thing, I don't know how deeply in the weeds you want to go, is de minimis that we can talk about, which is another structural feature that we focus
love
on.
Love to talk about that.
Can further change your expected return on a given bond after taxes. Yeah. So, you know, positioning yourself in such a way where you're insulated from large rate moves is very important. I think, again, relative to an index, which just buys the market, you can be positioned, you know, in a less inferior way.
Do you think the issues with de minimis are largely gone right now?
No, I mean, you're still finding a lot of 4% coupon bonds trading at discounts, which would put them into de minimis, certainly shorter bonds and especially sometimes longer bonds too. So de minimis has not gone away. The question is, do you take de minimis risk over positive convexity? And yeah, that's something each portfolio manager has to decide in the context of their portfolio around their expected holding period too. For example, if I hold a bond for 1 year, and, you know, I think the price will appreciate, I can sell it after that year and de minimis will have a lot less of an impact, especially if I'm not using a straight line de minimis method, using more of a constant yield method. So there are different ways to structure or position your portfolio to take advantage of both convexity and minimize the de minimis risk at the same time.
You know, something that's really been interesting to me since de minimis has been such an issue, I would say over the last year, especially folks, you know, deploying that strategy in separately managed accounts and how you actually account for the tax implications for those holders, right? Because it's hard to sort of buy it en masse in a sleeve of accounts when everybody has a different sort of tax issue. And so I'm like, how do you do that when it comes to a mutual fund as well, right? Because you're providing exempt income and now you're adding this, you know, taxable element into it.
Yeah, we evaluate, you know, our internal constraints on what would trigger de minimis and so forth, and what would trigger a tax loss for that matter. And based on our constraints, we go out into the market and make sure we can execute on various swaps or you know, trades that would minimize the impact of taxable income. And some of that is simply using tax loss carry forwards that we've generated over the last couple of years. And some of it is, you know, avoiding trades that we think are inferior because of the amount of after-tax income they produce.
You know, a lot of people were of the opinion that, you know, part of the savior for returns last year was the huge, huge volume of swapping going on. You know, obviously we don't have that same sort of rally tailwind to carry us. I mean, do you see that as being a big deficit for the market this year?
Now, I want to make sure I understand your question properly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're talking about a win for the sell side because of the amount of volume trading.
Correct. And that sort of almost like led to a win for the buy side as well, right? Sort of like think about it like a snake eating its tail in a sense, right? Everything just sort of fed upon itself. And it was a perfect storm, right? And we saw that resulting in the best November returns we've seen, I think, over the last like decade and a half, almost the same for December.
Yeah, so I'd push back and I'd say the returns really were in line with the pivot from the Federal Reserve that bring rates down pretty dramatically. Whereas the amount of volume that was traded over the course of last year, to your point, was related to tax loss swapping. But you know, as a lot of that a lot of those losses have been realized, you won't see that same volume into this year. That's my expectation.
Do you guys do any sort of supply forecasting? I mean, I feel like it's not one of my favorite subjects, but just curious sort of how you view the technical aspect of the market.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly look at others who are forecasting supply. And, you know, to start the year, for example, I think a lot of people were in the $400 billion camp, which was not that big of an increase, call it 5% over last year. But I think, you know, as this year starts to unfold, there are new shoots of potential additional supply. One example would be BAB calls. I mean, it's been a hot topic as of the last couple of weeks, but these BABs are called and refinanced into the tax-exempt market, I mean, I've seen supply estimates upwards of $60 billion if, you know, ratios continue to stay at these very expensive levels. So that in and of itself could add 10-15% to supply on the year.
I want to pivot over to credit and get your view on the credit market. You know, our point of view is that we've reached peak credit. What are your thoughts? Do you also see that, or are you more or less bullish for what munis are doing on the credit side?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, but I think peak credit has this negative connotation, which makes us think that credit will deteriorate from here. I think we're in a pretty strong place as we stand, you know, just taking general state and local governments. I mean, rainy day funds are as high as they've virtually ever been. So, you know, one area that a lot of people point to is California that is projecting a massive deficit from this point forward. And we can go into the specifics of why that's the case. But at the end of the day, this is the first time that we've looked at in the last 10 years or so, where California, more than 10 years, I think it's 20 years, where California has been facing a budget deficit, but also has a rainy day savings fund to help it get through that. And I think that's emblematic of a lot of local governments these days. And yes, it's true, our headline view is weakflation, the economy will continue to moderate, But I think tax collections are at really strong levels too, certainly post-COVID. So yeah, we believe we've hit a peak in credit, but we also believe we'll stay near these really strong levels.
So, I mean, that's a pretty rosy perspective, I have to say. I mean, look, I sit in front of a terminal all day where I'm blasted by news headlines, and we're trying to build like this like sentiment tracker for all the local headlines that are coming out, because I've seen like a huge uptick in budget deficit or personnel cuts or stories along those ilk, right? Which would definitely say sort of the opposite, especially as like much of this pandemic cash expires. I mean, how do you see that all playing out?
Yeah, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, sales tax collection, for example, is highly correlated to the economy. As long as the economy is growing in some sort of way, and there are various elements and outcomes and possibilities, certainly recession is one of them. But I think, mainstream conventional wisdom is that the soft landing probability is growing, certainly as the economy stays resilient. So as long as there's growth in the underlying economy, I'd expect growth in some of these more cyclical revenue triggers for states and local governments.
Do you see any of the, I guess, like the softer budgets having an impact on higher education at all, especially state-funded schools?
We've seen in the past where, take Illinois, for example, when you're having budget issues, they can certainly push that down to universities and that could impact the rating. But at this point, given the strength of, states primarily, I don't see that to be a widespread issue in the next 12 months.
Interesting. So where do you sort of see the biggest potholes, let's say, in the road of municipal credit?
Yeah, I mean, some of the you talked about higher education, but you didn't talk about private higher education, where I think there.
I was going to get to that.
As you put it, deeper potholes. That's a segment of the market that was under pressure really even before the pandemic, and some of their issues: too much leverage, tuition discounting, acceptance rates, and so forth. That's going to continue to balloon. And we've all seen a number of headlines already seeing these small liberal arts colleges close their doors because they can't afford to pay their debt anymore. Yeah. So I expect to see more of that, maybe some more consolidation in the private higher ed space. But another area we look to, and it's been well covered, is healthcare. And there's a range of headwinds in healthcare, anywhere from nursing shortages, utilization issues, general expense pressures, and it seems to have impacted even the strongest systems. So we think that's going to continue to be a headwind. And though we are seeing recovery in some of the larger systems, it's not to pre-pandemic levels. And again, if your profitability is lower, that inhibits your ability to build your balance sheet. So I think healthcare will certainly have those headwinds continue for the next year or two.
Let's talk a little bit about high yield. What are some areas that you like within high yield, and what are some areas that may be causing you some concern?
Sure. So one thing I like to say about high yield is if there's any sector where people are broadly crossing sectors out because of the credit risk, there's probably some diamonds in the rough there. So just because you don't like a sector doesn't mean you don't like all the credits in the sector. So one example I'd point to is senior living. There are a number, if you just look at similar to the healthcare picture we just drew, a number of headwinds, expense pressures, and then the housing market too, which is, yes, it's true, the price continues to grow, but the number of homes changing hands is certainly lower, which could pressure the sector. And then on top of that too, you have some of the nursing reimbursement issues. So that's a sector that's hurting, but we have been able to find a number of names that have been resilient, continue to keep a strong demand profile and look good despite those headwinds, strong balance sheets and so forth. So that's one area we invest. Another area, tobacco. Tobacco certainly has its headwinds. If you look, the FDA was ready to release rules about menthol bands. And, you know, also on the horizon potentially is the amount of nicotine that you're allowed to include in cigarettes. So a lot of regulatory changes potentially coming down the pipeline. Yeah. Again, I think the presidential election will probably push some of that off. But there's, despite year-over-year drops that seem to be out of line historically, we still think there's a lot of potential in that sector, as an example.
I mean, it seems like you're just extremely bullish on the market, which is obviously like a good thing for your clients to hear, because you wouldn't come in and like be like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh about how bad the market is. But, you know, look, for our listeners who are trying to sort of poke holes in your thesis, you know, what are some legitimate areas of, you know, that sort of stick out to you as like, look, everything is great, .. but.
Okay, we'll do the caveat question, yeah, the qualifier.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, looking at where we are, I'm going to move back away from credit and back to the big picture and technicals. If you look at ratios right now, and that is, you know, tax exempt levels relative to taxable levels, by almost every historical measure, we seem to be pretty tight there. And you know, as you mentioned, we've become more and more retail driven. Well, you know, at the end of the day, when an individual is deciding whether they buy a corporate bond or a municipal bond, they're going to be looking at what they expect their after-tax income to be. And, you know, unless that ratio becomes more attractive, I think that's going to hold a lot of retail buyers up. The same is true with insurance buyers, right? A lot of insurance buyers have a bogey, and they're looking at certain yields. And if those yields don't become cheap enough, you're going to lose a good part of the institutional market too. And then on top of that, you know, we talked about the supply. The supply, we've started this market in a massive way. I think the 60 plus billion we saw in January and February, that's the most supply we've seen in the first 2 months of a year since 2007. So if the supply continues to come in heavily, yes, we've had the reinvestment to digest that. But what happens when reinvestment falls off in March and April as tax season rolls around, right? That could certainly create issues, certainly with supply and demand imbalances. So those would be my caveats there. And then, of course, on the credit side, I'll just throw in my caveat is we've been talking about positive nominal growth, but certainly if a recession does materialize, and it could be coming from a number of areas, right? Commercial real estate is something we didn't really talk about, but you know, that's certainly an area of the market that could weigh down the rest of the economy. And if there's truly a recession, that could hurt more than just a small segment of the market.
And my last question, and I think it's something that I've heard probably more chatter about than I would care to, given that I've spent my whole career in tax-exempt bonds. Do you think the exemption is in any way, shape, or form at risk this year as we head into the election, just giving all of sort of the topics that we sort of started off the conversation about?
Yeah, as you pointed out, I'm the evergreen optimist. So, you know, it's been put forward as a pay for many times and never actually used. So, you know, that makes me feel pretty good about the chances. I think it will always be a topic of discussion, certainly as, you know, federal deficits are coming more and more into the spotlight. But realistically, the amount that it's good for won't move the needle very much. And I think there's such a strong advocacy group in Washington for states and local governments. It would really be hard to see it go away entirely.
I hope you're part of that advocacy group. You're selling me on the exemption being around forever. I love it. Just sort of like pulling that string a little bit, though, we had a lot of headlines that were not very good for the industry in the fall in regards to private higher education, right? And some of the statements that were coming out from some of these institutions. You know, to me, it seemed like a lot of eyes were directed on that sector and started the questioning of why are these entities allowed to issue tax exempt? Especially ones with $50, $40, $30 billion of endowments. Do you think that at all could be an issue going forward?
Yeah, you know, I would one-up you here and say stadium financing is one that's been looked at a number of times. Is this
such
really
a good point?
Okay for tax exempt? And, you know, I think some stadiums have actually been able to secure private financing too. So yeah. With that possibility in the proof that you can actually do it without subsidies from the federal government. Could that be altered in the future? I can certainly see that possibility. But again, nothing at this point makes me think that there will be any change to the tax exemption currently.
Good. All right. I'm going to sleep at night. Jason Appleson, the forever optimist when it comes to munis. It has been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us this month.
Thank you, Jason.